open-minded towards criticism and towards feedback. When you're a doer, you need it.
There is no perfect way to cook. And so if every single dish is coming out perfect, then I'm being lied to. I need to find that criticism and seek it out. Iron sharpens iron. I want to be as good as I can at my craft, move the needle and progress. You can't progress without criticism. Failure is the first step in iterating. You know, there is no need to come back and do something better if you did it perfect on the first time, which means that you failed in some form on that first one, no matter how good or how bad the outcome was. It's a form of criticism. There's something to be learned from a failure. Just keep one eye in the telescope and the other eye in the microscope. That's focusing on your long term. Figure out where you want to be, what's your 5-year goals, what's your 10-year goals. As you go about your day to day, as you're looking through the microscope at the minute details of everyday life, think about how is what I'm seeing here relating to that big picture, and just continually try to relate it back to the big picture. And if it doesn't line up, cut it. And if it does, build it.
One in the telescope, one in the microscope. I've never heard that
before.
Appreciate
it. I'm sure I stole it from somewhere.
We're giving it to Chef Wong. Boom.
There we go.
Welcome back to another episode of the Chats with Clark podcast. I'm your host, Joe Clark, and here at Chats with Clark, we don't do poppy intros. We get straight to the point. The point of today's episode, episode 67, is Logan Neisel, penning the name of Chef Lone. He's the creative mind behind Cleveland's Prologue Dinner Series, the founder of the North Coast Culinary Group, and a self-trained, revered chef, Logan. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Happy to be here, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. But my first question to you, Logan, simply is, what is the best thing that there is to know about you?
The best thing to know? Wow, that's a good question. I'd say probably the best thing to know is that I'm constantly curious. So for me, food is the current medium that I'm exploring with that curiosity. In the past, before I got into food, I had a full career in data analytics. Exploring data and understanding technology was the outlet for that creativity. Before that, I was in theater. So yeah, all of it is kind of how do I figure out how to kind of take that creative spark and implement it into whatever kind of medium I'm working in.
That's beautiful. It's when you have that as part of your personality, the world's your oyster, because there's so many parts of our world that we can just dive into.
Sure.
And it's fascinating to hear that you have theater in your background, because we're right here in the Playhouse Square District, but I'm gonna let you paint the scene a little bit. Set the scene for us. Where are we in this awesome space?
So we are currently in Encore Cocktail Lounge here in Playhouse Square. It's a beautiful Art Deco cocktail lounge that pairs signature drinks with small bites. The idea here is that you would be out of place having one and not the other. It's been a very, creative challenge for me, or it's a good challenge creatively for me to be able to do this. The idea of pairing food with cocktails is not new, but the idea of it being so intertwined that one couldn't exist without the other is, I think, the big draw here. So yeah, absolutely beautiful. With it being in Playhouse Square, we pull a lot of the Art Deco kind of design elements without pulling all of the pretentiousness that went into 1920s. So beautiful space, beautiful people, great place to have a conversation, and an even better place to have a drink and a little bite to eat too.
It is. When I walked in, I told Logan, I said, it makes me want to have a drink. The ambiance and the environment is just so catering to that. I want a drink with a little bite. It's perfect. Yeah,
the owners, Abbas Manvawala and Ben Lyons, have done an amazing job curating the space, and I'm very happy to be working alongside of them to bring the food element and to make sure that the taste matches the sight and the sound and everything else that goes into the experience they're providing.
Before we totally dive into that experience, I am curious, how did you pen the name Chef Lone? Where did that come from?
So my background was in tech. I played a lot of video games growing up. You needed to have a username whenever you were going to play video games. My name's Logan Neisel, so I just kind of took the first couple of letters of my first name and the first couple of letters of my last name, smashed them together, and that became Lone. Lone Ganzel is the full username if you find me on Xbox or whatever. That's where you'll find me under. But Chef Lone became the moniker whenever we finally decided to get into social media and start to put some of the food content that I was creating out into the world.
It's perfect. It's a great. It's really catchy. So I loved it. Yeah. I knew there had to be a story behind it. It was too creative for it not to be.
And you know, after putting it out, it kind of made sense too, because I learned all of the cooking stuff on my own through like just self-taught YouTube and stuff. So it's like, yeah, I actually am just lone, like just me doing it on my own for better or worse. So, but it's been a great experience, and now the moniker's kind of stuck. And yeah, sometimes people know me as Lone versus Logan. Either way, I definitely look, and I just hope that you're enjoying whatever's in front of you.
And as you kind of mentioned, we're in this space now that really blends the cocktail with the bite. How do you find that you wanted to get into this space, or that you would excel in a space like this?
Sure. So with the North Coast Culinary Group, the idea is to try to bring my idea of North Coast cuisine to the Cleveland area in whatever format that can be. Whether that's me doing my 6-course dinner, the prologue dinner series, or that's working alongside existing spaces or other hospitality groups to help elevate their food content. Whenever I was first approached by the Encore group to do food here, the idea was that they knew that they wanted somebody that was going to be able to provide the food, but obviously being in a cocktail lounge, there wasn't a full kitchen for me to work out of to be an executive chef here. So what we finally agreed to, and what has now become kind of another wing of the North Coast Culinary Group, is a private label, or like a wholesaler kind of a setup, where I consult with the clients to figure out what are your guys' needs, what kind of space constraints are we working in, or what can I kind of use as the framework for building out your guys' menu. I then go away, I produce a few food test items, we try them, we figure out if we like it, whatever clicks. We then set up a contract, and I produce them in my prep kitchen, and I'm able to then bring whatever I produce there into here. So for me, it's great. I'd never be able to operate a cocktail lounge. You know, I'm independent. I recently started this, so getting a brick and mortar is still on the list of to-dos. But it allows me to get my food out into the world, and in a place where I know that it's going to be appreciated. Being in Playhouse Square and having the creative engine that is the theater district really allows, you know, more creative aspects to pile on top and be appreciated. And so for them, they get food that they know is going to sell well, that's well acquainted with their brand and is going to work within their space. And then for me, I'm able to build out a monthly recurring revenue stream that people that are kind of in the pop-up scene maybe don't necessarily have, but is absolutely lucrative on top of the ticketing aspect. It's great to have those big, you know, ticket sales, but that means every single month you're trying to find 30 to 60 new people to come eat. Mm-hmm. With a wholesale account like this, it's business to business. I know that we're together for at least the next month, for the next year. And so because of that, the ability to spend more time on the creative side of things, on creating new dishes and focusing on the 6-course dinner becomes a more, what I want to say, creative focused kind of endeavor, as opposed to it being something where I'm worried about, is this creative and is this profitable? The wholesale is profitable. That takes care of that. That allows the fine dining aspect to really just be whatever it is that I want it to be.
That style of bringing food in, I feel like, has been almost like with caterers, right? Has been around for so long. It's tried and tested.
Oh, definitely.
So I love that you can just do that. It opens so many doors for you to be, if this subsides, you can go on to the next and just keep that ball moving.
Definitely. As we look like post-COVID at restaurants, I see that, you know, trying to have just that one revenue stream can be very, very difficult, especially if you're in fine dining where your margins are already low and your labor is already very high. As all of your kind of your profit margins start to get squeezed, you start to panic and say, is this something that I can sustain? I think especially with examples like Kasama in Chicago, where you see a restaurant where by day is a diner and by night is fine dining, has allowed them to kind of tap into two separate markets or two different revenue streams, where you've got the daily, you know, people that'll come in mass and buy something for like $15 for lunch and brunch. But then at night, they're still able to put on that creative air and say, you know, sure, we sell this by day, but by night, this is what we do. And it's this elevated kind of thing. It has allowed them to kind of weather the storm. And so when I started North Coast Culinary Group, I almost knew by definition that if I wanted to operate a fine dining something in post-COVID, it had to have other revenue streams supporting it.
What is some of that inspiration behind the fine dining for you? How do you decide this is what you want to put on the menu?
Sure. For me, so when I say North Coast cuisine, that for me is a framework that I use to create all of my dishes. So There's three major elements for my version of it. I grew up with my Nona's cooking was gourmet cooking for me growing up. So Italian cuisine has kind of been what I focused on through, you know, self-teaching myself through the internet. A lot of what I was landing on were like Japanese game shows from like the 90s. Iron Chef was really big. And so Japanese cuisine started to layer in as another kind of pillar of the cuisine that I have. And then being from Ohio, I wanted to make sure that I had something that I could kind of latch on here and make it so that it was not just me, you know, importing ingredients from all over the world, but actually making it sit and feel at home as if it was always here. So those three kind of serve as the overarching framework for the way that I produce any of the dishes. I like to draw a lot of the inspiration for the food from Cleveland. So, you know, with the cigar, the idea there is that we spent some time over in the old cigar lounge in Playhouse Square, where, you know, in the 20s, guys would come in and they'd sit and they'd have their drink and their smoke during intermission, and then they'd be able to go back down or just go up there for meetings or whatever. And being able to kind of pull from that cultural peak of the Gilded Era, I think is something that Cleveland kind of, especially in Playhouse Square, we're sitting in the shadow of that time. And so being able to pull ideas from then, but adapt them to the current time while layering in the Italian and the Japanese cuisine elements to kind of spice it up and make it feel more modern is ultimately what I've landed on. The idea of having food with a story is really the important part for me. If I'm making food and it just tastes good and it looks good and it sits on a plate and people eat it and the biggest thing that they remember about it is the taste, then I feel like I haven't gotten to that artistic level that I really crave. So, you know, being able to say this is a cigar, that it's a Buckeye, but we shape it like a cigar because you're in Playhouse Square where that kind of thing was a commonality, I think is really great. I think being able to pull inspiration from all of the different cultural centers that we've got in Cleveland, the Museum of Arts that we have, both the Contemporary Museum of Art and the Cleveland Museum of Art that we have so many different artworks and exhibitions that come through. And so being able to look at those and see, you know, what has been culturally significant for Cleveland, how can I pull that into my food and my cooking is kind of the thing that I see as separating it from just a meal. You walk away from that dinner thinking about the inspiration more so than the flavors. And that for me is going to be the thing that makes me feel like I'm a success.
You're bringing people together, Logan. You're tying together different cultures and also tying in directly to our Northeast Ohio realm. And I think that's amazing because if you were to focus just primarily on future things or just primarily on the past, then you kind of would miss a little bit of the present, right? And so to have all of that blending allows people to buy into the community that they're already in, where they're experiencing it. So not only are they hearing the story, but they're in the environment.
Definitely.
What do you think about, and did you ever imagine that you'd be in, coming from a tech world and running analytics, did you ever think you'd be in the environment now that you're creating spaces for people to collaborate and just to enjoy a conversation, to dive into that history?
So I think I'd be lying if I said that this was always the goal from the beginning. The pivot into food happened after, you know, I built up my career in tech. I found that because I was in tech, I was able to just get DoorDash every single night, and it, you know, started to become a problem. So as a New Year's resolution, I said, let's start cooking at home instead of ordering out every single night. So I spent all of January eating bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich for lunch and chicken and rice for dinner. The typical like bro setup where I'm like, I'm getting my protein. I don't know what else I need, but I know I'm hitting those goals. And it got to a point where I was pretty much ready to stop it. So I was complaining to my boss at the time, and she said, you know, why don't you just take this Julia Child cookbook that I've got, The Art of French Cooking, read through it. Maybe you'll be able to memorize some new recipes or whatever, and you'll be able to, you know, break out of the one meal that you know how to cook. I said, all right, great. Well, you know, I don't really want to memorize recipes because that for me was what cooking always was. I didn't know that there was like more to it besides just looking at what Escoffier made in forever ago and just repeating that. So when I open the cookbook and I see the first two chapters are not recipes, but more about here is what an acid does. Here's a fat. Here's how you would set up your kitchen to operate and not have, you know, a bunch of stuff that you just buy off of Amazon and just fill your drawers, like how you can practically organize things and how you can think about food and create your own recipes. That that moment, once I understood that there was a thought process behind it, kind of lit a spark of creativity. So I really, really love the idea of what I'm doing. It's not necessarily something that I thought I was going to be doing. You know, obviously pivoting from tech into food is a big pivot. But now that I've kind of found that creative passion in food, I love to be able to help others to see that passion and help them to grow it beyond just a hobby and really turn it into a career. And for those that are in the industry, I see, you know, what I'm doing, the platform that I'm starting to build as not just a platform for me, like the Prologue Dinner Series. The reason why it's called the Prologue was it was meant to be the intro to my story. And after I do this pop-up series, that I would be moving on to my actual adventure. But what I've found is that through meeting other people, there are so many stories that should be told in Cleveland that haven't yet had the opportunity to be told. And so I want this to become a platform, not where I'm just here to make some money and like sell some food, but really turn it into an incubator program where, you know, maybe you've got a background in another industry, but you cook on the side and you'd like to be able to host your first event. Well, maybe you don't have all of the pieces together, but I know all of the stuff. So let me coach you on that and give you this platform and help market it so that you can, you know, get out there and try it. And maybe you love it. Maybe you go off and you do your own thing and stay in Cleveland and you build up, you know, more of a following for yourself. Or maybe you try it once and you realize it's not for you and you move on to whatever it is that is your next kind of creative passion. But I think that building those spaces, helping to incubate the talent that's here and giving them the opportunity to not just develop within their current role, but to get to that next level of like, be an executive chef, being the one who's driving the creativity and having a brand behind your name that you're proud of and that's your signature is really where I want the Prologue Dinner Series to go. And I'm very, very happy to be able to give that kind of a platform to younger chefs or people that are coming in from other industries, just like I did.
Totally. And I love that the business and the recipient can also just dive right into that too.
Definitely.
How many restaurants are you in right now, Logan?
So Playhouse, right now I am just with Encore as far as my wholesale setup. But I do partner with at least three or four different restaurants in the area to host my pop-up dinner series. Mm-hmm. Through 2025, I spent a lot of time both downtown here and in Ohio City. Now in 2026, the idea for the Prologue Dinner Series is to partner and to have more of a presence within the food industry. And so I'm starting to work with other local chefs in the area to kind of collaborate on dinners. So, you know, 2025 is me working kind of as a separate entity to a lot of the food and beverage kind of groups that are in the area. But now in 2026, my goal is to get more embedded, spend more time collaborating and really trying to grow not just myself, but the whole scene as much as I can.
How do you find out about the stories that you end up diving into with your pieces?
That, I think, is a benefit of the Cleveland food industry. The chefs that are here, the ones that are kind of on the cutting edge of Cleveland food, are extremely supportive of others in the industry. I walk, you know, when I'm just starting out on my own, I'm walking into Cordelia down the street and Chef Vinny is calling me chef. You know, three James Beard nominations and he still is humble enough to call some guy who just self-calls himself chef. That was very validating. So as I work with chefs like him or with like Chef Josh Erickson over at Rude in Lakewood, getting together with those guys and realizing that the desire to incubate talent in the city and to grow Cleveland as a food destination is not a unique thing to me, is what has allowed me to kind of build these networking groups and start to hear not just the executive chefs, but their sous chefs. You know, say I'm doing one of my dinners and I don't have enough people to help. I can reach out to the chefs that I know are there and they'll offer to have some of their people come and help me, because one, it helps me, but two, it helps them in the long term because their team is able to go learn some new skills from a different chef. It's a temporary kind of thing, so there's no like worry about poaching their talent, and I obviously benefit by having enough hands to actually get things done.
Sure.
So the opportunity to build relationships with head chefs and get to know their teams and understand who is high performing, who is got the spirit, but maybe is looking to like learn the skills to like back up that side of things, is the kind of benefit, I think, of that. So, you know, you can go into another city and people are a lot quieter, or things happen behind closed doors, or they're not willing to share or talk to other chefs because they see them as competition. I feel like the Cleveland community is very much built around collaboration as opposed to competition. We're a small city, we got our chip on our shoulder, right? And so we all kind of realize that if we work together, we can compete with some of the bigger names, some of the bigger cities, and start showing people that, you know, it's not just one restaurant in Cleveland that's doing this, there's a whole community. And so as one kind of draws new people, everybody gets to benefit from that. And we see the entire city start to just become a more conducive and a more food driven kind of area.
And you hit the nail on the head on that. The businesses here love to collaborate. So let's say I'm a customer and I'm coming in and I'm sitting down for one of the dinners.
Sure.
Walk me through it. What should I expect in my 6-course dinner?
Sure. So with our supper club setup, the way that we want people to walk away, we want you to remember the inspiration behind the dishes. So for me, the food is a combination of flavor and the art or the kind of inspiration behind it. So you sit at a table communally with everybody else around you that's signed up. I do that on purpose. I want people to be able to talk with each other and to be able to share connections over whether you guys enjoy the flavors or you enjoy the inspiration or the presentation or just the scene that we're in, the location that we're at. I want people to walk away with the feeling of this was an inspired experience that had a lot of the human element behind it, that conversation, that me coming out and talking to people after dinner, but also in between courses to just not only explain what's going on, but ask, you know, is there anything that I can do for you? Is there anything that we can do in addition to the food to make you feel at home, is really important for me.
And so we sit down, and are you cooking almost like hibachi style? You're kind of cooking behind a counter and we're all around you?
With the setup that I currently have, because I'm popping up in different locations, the setup is kind of determined by wherever it is that I'm at. Ideally, I'd love to get that set up. I mean, you go to like a teppanyaki or like a hibachi kind of setup where your chef is right in front of you and the food, actually cooking the food as part of the performance, is something that I'd love to be able to get into, especially in Playhouse Square. The whole, you know, the theater background is, it's the performer in me wants to see something like that happen. And so, yeah, as we inch our way towards a more consistent kind of model, I think you'll start to see more of the theatrical aspects come in. Right now, what you see as far as theatrics is mostly confined to the plate. But for me, like I said, food should not just be the flavor. It shouldn't just be what you see in front of you. It should be like beyond that. And so figuring out how I take the experience beyond the plate is absolutely where I want to go, and hopefully a takeaway that people have whenever they come to the dinners.
To our audience, if you haven't yet, hop onto Chef Lone's Instagram and see all of the different plates. We'll have them throughout the video, but if you're not watching and you're just listening, definitely take a second head to his Instagram and check it out, because so many of the pieces just are striking. I mean, it's literally art.
I appreciate it. Well, yeah. Like I said, a lot of it comes from the fact that Cleveland has such a rich cultural history. With a lot of the dishes that I post, you know, you'll see a picture of the food, but then the next picture is the inspiration behind it. Mm-hmm. I've got a dish that I'm doing in the spring here that's at its core, it's just a egg and potato mixed salad. But the way that I structure it, the potato gets shaved into shoestrings and then baked in the shape of a nest. The egg is a small quail's egg that's soft-boiled, peeled, and then we submerge it in pea flower tea for 2 days so it dyes it like a light blue color. We take the Parmesan cheese that goes on it and we shred it super thin and we freeze it so that it's got a cold aspect to it. The ultimate setup then is to make it resemble kind of a robin's nest. Mm-hmm. In Northeast Ohio, and especially in my family, my grandma always competes to see who's going to be the first one to see the robins. It's kind of the signal for spring, or, you know, the hopeful sign that the snow is starting to go away. Mm-hmm. And so having that kind of childhood experience was like, really, it was kind of a foundational thing for me. Every time I see robins, I think about my grandmother, and so I wanted to have a dish that kind of distilled that. It's not revolutionary by any flavor perspective, and I'm not doing like molecular techniques, but every technique is intentionally trying to draw back to that inspiration and make sure that the overall experience is not just about eating, you know, soft-boiled eggs. Anybody can soft-boil an egg, but only I have had that inspiration or that memory to build into this dish. And so that I feel like has been the way that I try to define my cuisine. It's not overly complex. I'm not spending a million hours a day putting like individual blades of grass or something like tweezery onto my dishes. Italian cuisine or Italian culture, the term is sprezzatura, doing it without looking like you're trying hard. And in Japan, they have a very similar philosophy around not complicating things. You just keep everything as simple as it can possibly be. And so for me, I'll build a dish. It'll have a million different concepts or a million different components included in it. But then I start to pull away and say, how much of this can I take away before I'm losing the essence of what it is that I'm ultimately trying to communicate with this dish? And for a lot of it, it is all of the extraneous, you know, things that you might see in a typical fine dining space that is, you know, beautiful, but can kind of ring hollow whenever you ultimately take a step back, or once you finish eating it, like, you don't necessarily, you know, think about the fact that, oh, each one of these individual sun kernels was placed by hand in that specific scenario. You might even forget about that dish. But for me, the amount of effort that goes in is directly related to the clarity of communication that I can get with the idea.
It really is art, and I think you nail it with the simple elegance, especially because it differentiates it from just going to, say, a steakhouse and like everything looks good. It looks good,
sure,
but you eat it and I don't know, I mean, it tastes great, that's the end of it, yeah, as opposed to really appreciating the art perspective of it.
I appreciate that. That's, yeah, especially with me doing fine dining in the Midwest, what I want to make sure is that people understand that it's not just about the price of the food, because we have amazing food here in the Midwest that doesn't get fancy and get all dressed up. I mean, you can get a locally processed pork, no problem, and make your pork chops at home that are going to rival anything that you can get in any of the great diners or any of the great like steakhouses around the area. But for me, that creativity, the intentionality behind the presentation and the inspirations is what separates it from just the eating for sustenance. And what I hopefully can get across to the customer is that you're going to end up going home full. Like, we're in the Midwest. I will not serve somebody a meal that you do not go home feeling satisfied and like you had a full dinner. But I also want people to not just eat. I want them to taste. If I can, you know, pull the cheesy line from the menu, it's you can eat for the sake of not being hungry, but you taste for the creative aspects. You taste to see the intricacies and the amount of effort and the technique that goes into something. And so being able to really drive home the intentionality and the art behind it, I think allows people to realize like, oh, this is as if I was going to a show at Broadway, but I also get to eat it. So that, I think, helps people understand the price point a little bit, especially if you're just expecting a meal, because you can eat amazing food for much less than what you can do here. But the inspiration and the takeaway that you get from it is what I think separates it from just somewhere where you can go and eat, and takes it into that tasting or kind of fine art kind of territory.
I always joke with my mom and my sister about that. I'm like, you know, sometimes I'm just eating. It's less of an experience for me because I'm just trying to get by, you know. And then there's other times when you're eating, and it is. It's so much of an experience, and it's the people you're with, and it's the art of the food and the deliciousness of it that is less of just living to eat.
Sure.
Or, yeah, eating to live, excuse me. And one thing I was thinking about prior to us diving into our conversation, how do you manage the notion that basically, fine dining is less of what is American culture, in the sense that I feel like when we order, we get copious serving sizes.
Sure.
How do you navigate that?
So I think this is one of the benefits of growing up in the Midwest is, for me, the fine dining is not necessarily the mini plates of, you know, three or four, you know, little bites, and then at the end of it you go and buy McDonald's to like actually fill up. Like I grew up here, I know that people want to eat a full meal, and that if you have food and you don't leave feeling satisfied, then you didn't get what you paid for. And so for me, what I've done is, especially with the Ohio influence in my food, I try to make sure that I'm representing that. If you are a meat and potatoes guy, well, I've got a course that is meat and potatoes, and you are going to love it, and it's going to be big and filling. And if you want seconds, let me know. We'll come out and we'll get it for you. But the idea is to adjust the way that people see fine dining so that it's not so focused on the taste that you forget the actual reason why the food exists. Like, people come together at the dinner table, they eat the food, but it's more about like your conversation that you can have. And so for me, I wanted to make sure that the food never became a distraction from that. I didn't want you to say, well, I didn't get enough, and so I left early or whatever. Yeah, with my dinners, you're going to have six courses of food. I'm going to make sure that those six courses equal out to at least the same amount of food that you would get if you were to go to like a Texas Roadhouse or something. If you're just going for the food, you're going to walk away full. That is absolutely certain. But what I hope is that as you're there and you're eating and you're getting full, you're starting to appreciate the extra thought that went into it. So will you need to go to McDonald's? Absolutely not. That is my goal, is that you never have to go there after one of my dinners. But I also am not going to just hit you with like one big plate. I'm going to give you the same amount of volume, just spread across a lot of different inspirations, so that as you're filling up, you're getting different different ways to kind of spark thinking and give you multiple things to talk about with the people that you're eating with.
It really does break it down. It's not like the quick fix style that's so prevalent, right? I mean, you can go get a massive Chipotle bowl for minimal price. And so it flips all that on its head and still gives that great result while benefiting the conversations and the community along the way. And I think that's really tremendous. While I'm sitting here singing your praises and starving now, I happen to know that any business takes criticism, and especially when it's something near and dear to us, which food and community happens to be.
Sure.
How have you been able to deal with and navigate criticism while A, taking in some that's necessary and saying, okay, that's actually constructive and I can use that, and B, toning out any just inherently negative, sure, non-productive comments?
So when I was first starting to cook, I was posting my food online. And so for me, because I am kind of learning in a vacuum, I was doing that to hopefully garner criticism. And one of the very first, in fact, the very first dish that I put on Instagram, I call it a fettuccine Alfredo. It had cream, it had fresh cut pasta. It was a travesty to anybody that was Italian. And with luck, Italians saw it and reached out to me and said, hey, this isn't right. But the way that they reached out wasn't to insult or like to take what I'm doing and to push it down. What they were trying to do was help me to understand the cultural reason why it exists the way that it does. Understanding that Italian cuisine is very terroir driven, like where your food comes from is as important as the way that you cook it. And for them, you know, fettuccine Alfredo is something that is not necessarily done with cream. There's a reason why it's not done with cream, and it takes much too long to describe on this. We could have a whole podcast just talking about the way that Italians draw lines in the sand around their cuisine. But getting to talk with real Italians, and by posting my food online and talking with people online, the idea of like being nice or like talking about food just for the flavor kind of went away. And it was like very, very focused on like, how many likes was I getting? How was this dish being perceived by people? Am I describing it in a way that makes it sound interesting to people? So yeah, criticism was kind of from day one, something that I was hoping to get by posting things online. Like I said, the Italian community has been very, very supportive and helped me to understand the difference between, you know, Southern Italian cuisine versus Northern Italian cuisine. I've had I call them my international nonas. I have a grandmother from Italy who follows me, who every time I post something Italian, she gives me notes on how she might do it different. The panna cotta that I use is a family recipe from her family that she shared with me because I had made panna cotta and I screwed it up terribly. I have a Japanese woman who does basically the exact same thing, but for the Japanese side of cooking. So when I'm early on and I'm steaming sweet rice, she's kind of laughing, but also explaining to me why I should not be doing that, or, you know, explaining how to pair cuisines together, or how to understand the seasonality that goes into Japanese cuisine. So having that international support through the digital side of things, it came very early, and it was extremely inspiring, and it, I think, is what allowed me to see criticism not as a bad thing. Even if somebody is giving you criticism that's not constructive, you are the one who ultimately decides how that is perceived. And so, you know, if somebody gives me the Gordon Ramsay treatment, I'm going to walk away from the situation so I don't blow up, because that's going to be my first inclination. But then as I'm thinking about it, I'm going to figure out how can I take what they said and really hone it so that it's part of what I'm doing. You know, if I put out every dish and everybody says that it's great, then I've surrounded myself with too many yes men, and I need to expand my circle. I need to get more people in, because I know that there is no perfect way to cook. And so if every single dish is coming out perfect, then I'm being lied to. And I need to find that criticism and seek it out, because, you know, iron sharpens iron. I want to be as good as I can at my craft. And that means taking in as many opinions and getting as many people that are saying, maybe not, to go, oh, maybe so. And really kind of move the needle and you know, progress is how I see. You can't progress without criticism, I don't think.
No. When you're a doer, you need it. Definitely. And to hear you going in right off the rip, open-minded towards criticism and towards feedback, is just so, A, humble, and B, a testimony to your desire to progress and, again, perfect that craft.
Thank you.
And just a quick nod to our audience, too. I think it's so interesting to hear about how important it is to have people in your corner. And also, I often get the question, like, oh, how did you end up wherever? Like, how did you end up in Encore? And it's to shoot, you know, your episode. And I think it strikes me, because my response is always the same. If you ask for things and you're honest about it and truthful and just, again, humble in your approach with it, I think the world is your oyster, which is what I keep hearing in Logan's stories here, talking about different people. I mean, having international nonas and people that are supporting you and offering their feedback in a way so that you can thrive is such a testimony, again, to that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's the, how do I want to describe it? It's one of the benefits, I think, of coming from the Midwest, right? We are nice to a fault, and so the support that you get and the kind of backing that comes from that is big. But we're talking about international people, so really the way that I should be answering that is, I think sincerity is magnetic, and so sincere people find ways to find each other. And so, yeah, as you know, you and I met each other through a third person who both knew us and both knew kind of the ideas that we had, and that we were, you know, looking to and a partner on something like this. So, but yeah, that's kind of the idea, is to try to just find the sincere people, keep them in your corner, and then just keep accumulating as many of those people as you can. Because, yeah, if they're going to be sincere and they're going to be, and they critique you, then you know that that's coming from a point of them wanting to help you improve. If they're sincere and they're saying yes, that what you're doing is great, then you know that they're not just saying that for the sake of saying it. It makes a big difference when you can find those people that are sincerely helping you to do better, and then you can then return the favor to them or to somebody else along the line.
So true. While you take in all of that sincere criticism and help and love, and while you stick to your guns with the goals and the drive that you have, what do you see as the end game for you and for just like the dinner series that you have?
Sure. So I see North Coast Culinary Group is going to move from sponsoring the Prologue Dinner Series as a pop-up concept to moving to a brick and mortar. I think that I would, with the amount of success that we're having and the amount of momentum that's come from our first year in business, I see that as an inevitability, especially if I want to be able to build an incubator program for other people. Mm-hmm. When that brick and mortar comes together, obviously the food that I do that's part of the Prologue Dinner Series will be pulled to that. But what I really want to see the Prologue Dinner Series turn into then is that incubator, that recurring space where young chefs, sous chefs, somebody that's wanting to get into the industry can take that first step, work with the North Coast Culinary Group, get coached up on the things that they don't know, and ultimately help them to tell their own story. Because, like I said, you can't build a food city off of one restaurant. It's got to be as many restaurants as you can possibly get. We've all got to be high quality. And so the Prologue Dinner Series should be that step that people take between going, I'm working for somebody else, I'm going to step out on my own. How do I do that? Let us help you write that first chapter of your story so that as you go on to write the subsequent chapters, you know that you have all of the tools that you need to actually make it happen.
Your vision's so great. And you mentioned that it's only been 1 year, and that blows my mind. What mindsets have you adopted that you've seen concretely have helped you to just scale in such an incredible way?
Sure. I think that understanding one of the biggest things was realizing that leadership is the same no matter what industry you're in. Mm-hmm. So when I was in tech, I was in there for a decade. I got to a point where I was managing a team. Guys who worked for me had more degrees than a thermometer. And for me, my job was to get out of their way and allow them to do their job successfully. I removed roadblocks and I tried to see what was coming up ahead of them that might slow them down, but I wasn't the one that was writing the programs or interacting with the spreadsheets. When I came to food, and because food has been around for so long, I feel like the mindset has been so built on that like apprentice and master relationship. Mm. That some chefs fear stepping out of that master role and getting into a more executive like leadership role. For me, when I started this, I knew that I am not the best cook. That's just the way that it is. I have a vision for things. I can produce it for myself, but I haven't spent 10 years working in this industry. Just like I didn't have the thermometer full of degrees that the guys who worked for me in tech had. So I knew that as I came in here, I was going to be trying to build people up and delegate what I was doing to those people. So for me, scaling wasn't figuring out how do I work harder, how do I work smarter? It was how do I find the people that know how to do this? How do I partner with cooks who are amazing at chopping and doing the day-to-day techniques that actually need to happen to put out a Michelin level kind of experience? How do I find business owners who have the relationships with investors so that as I'm talking about doing this, it's not just a thing where I'm trying to do it all on my own. I can actually, you know, work with other people and bring in their knowledge set. So for me, like I said, finding the way to translate the leadership skills that I learned in my tech career over to food and kind of using that as a kind of unique selling point, I think has been a big thing for me.
A mentor of mine has always said that the essence of leadership is to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. And he would always digress a little bit and mention that, you know, the smarter is you could fill it with any word you want. It's like a placeholder, right?
Sure.
The essence of leadership is surrounding yourself with someone who knows more than you, who has more experience than you, who is more creative than you. Just you could put any verb in there, or any, I guess, adjective, any characteristic in there. And that's how you build the team. And it takes that humility to know it.
Definitely.
But it's the art of collaboration that allows us to really thrive,
definitely.
I think.
Yeah.
Throughout your career so far, you've been able to collaborate with so many great individuals. Who stands out as maybe your favorite, and what did you take from them?
Sure. So of my collaborations, I have been working with a sous chef who has been working with me since my first pop-up. His name is Ryan Coltrona. He's a sous chef at a local area restaurant. It's his full-time job, but he loves the idea and is so deep into perfecting the craft that when I went to him and said, hey, I need hands to help me put out my first dinner, no problem, chef, I'll be there. Working with him and being able to see the amount of thought and effort that goes into something like this and like seeing his creative spark, I think has really kind of pushed my own creativity and pushed me to want to be better. He's young, he's got a lot of great ideas, but he hasn't necessarily had the opportunity to do it on his own. And so as I'm working with him, I'm starting to realize, like, you know, one, he's got this amazing, amazing talent and this amazing vision for where he wants to go, but because he hasn't worked outside of food, he doesn't necessarily know how to do like a marketing thing or something like that. So there were skills that he had that were amazing, and then skills that he needed to develop. And so being able to kind of see his needs or kind of see the way that he wanted to grow himself as a chef and marry that up with the kind of direction that I was going helped me to see, like, this isn't just about me. Like, I can do something for him. And in fact, he's going to be the first sous chef that takes over and becomes a guest chef for the Prologue Dinner Series. So he's put together a full 6 courses of his own style of cooking, and I feel very, very proud to be able to give him the platform to do that. Because, like I said, I probably would have just killed off the Prologue Dinner Series when I got a brick and mortar had I not worked with him and seen the amount of creativity that was sitting just below the surface and just needed, you know, just one extra hand to just pull it up to that next level and give him the tools that he needed to do it. So
it's like that incubator program. There's your first person right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's absolutely it. And so, yeah, wherever he goes from now, I know he's got like ambitions to go to Chicago and do the Michelin route. I hope that what he learns here and the way that we've been able to incubate his talent allows him to just launch into that as quickly as he can. I think for some chefs, coming in and working with the Prologue Dinner Series could be the next step to them doing their own brick and mortar. I hope that by doing it here in Cleveland, they start to realize that there is a hotbed or there is an audience for this sort of thing. And over time, people feel that, you know, maybe I could go to Chicago, but if I'm already building something here, maybe I just continue to build on top of this. And what we see is fewer chefs seeing Cleveland as a launch point and more seeing it as the destination to end up.
You're in a field, Logan, that there's so much to learn, right? With food, it's just endless.
Sure.
How do you even go about trying to learn what you feel is enough?
Sure. Well, I think the benefit of living in the modern day is that the internet is, you know, that oracle for everything. So for me, going to YouTube and just looking up a recipe, watching 3 or 4 different chefs all make that recipe and see the differences or the nuances between it is really enlightening.
Nice.
Being able to use and leverage the technology that's available to us, I think is really the big thing that that drives chefs or really just drives anybody to be able to benefit themselves. Now, I think one of the drawbacks of having that dearth of information is that it becomes hard to focus. And so for me, in developing the North Coast cuisine style, building the box around what is North Coast cuisine, like what inspirations do I consider to be part of this and what is exterior, was really important. If I spent every single day trying to learn every single technique from every single cuisine, I'd never develop my own style. So I found the 3 or 4 things that I really held on to that I said, you know, these are my inspirations. And then I shut off as much exterior influence as I could so that what I did from that point forward was not repetitive or was not iterative of somebody else's idea. Japan, Italy, those flavors have come together multiple times, but if I don't see what other people are doing and I just kind of focus insularly on my own concept, then I can build something new. So use the internet, learn as much as you can so that you have a wide breadth of information to choose from. And then once you finally have that wide breadth, really just zoom in on what are the two or three things that are non-negotiables or things that I cannot take away without losing the essence of what I'm doing. And that allows you to then, you know, put on the side blinders and look forward as opposed to just continuing to build wide. You get to build vertically at that point.
I think you really bring up a great point. That's where we are as a society, is that we have such an incredible amount of information just at our fingertips at any given moment. And the same thing, everything is just to the nth degree of the max. And I think that that is really confusing for all of us in the sense that we feel like we need to know so much and do so much and be in all of these excessive states. Mm-hmm. But once, what I keep finding, what I think is so true, is that once you find what is you, which again, you nailed between the Japanese, the Italian, and the North Coast idea. When you find what is you, then it's like, okay, I need to get the shovel and I actually need to dig and I need to get as much information about that as I can, as opposed to that panoramic view.
Right.
And that would, I guess, just be my quick piece of thought for our audience too, is when you find the thing that makes you tick, or when you find what you excel at doing, then dive into that, as opposed to just keep the bountiful experiences are great.
Sure.
Until you try and know the most about everything, it's just impossible. So once you find out what's really great about you, diving into that and really making it yours and putting that twist on it is the bread and butter. Because, and I think we see that too in like trends, right? It's like we had that TikTok trend that was massive for a long time, just like of different dances. That was such a thing. But what made them trends is that everyone was trying to do it, except doing it their own way. And that was the ticket. If everyone just, like you said, with the recipes, you just rinse and repeat the recipes, it's not, it's just what it is, as opposed to Chef Lone's version of Pick Your Poison, or Joe Clark's version of a podcast. So when you find what makes you tick, make it your own, and then just really dive into that as far as a knowledge base. I think you really bring up a great point with that.
Thank you. No, absolutely. And that's, it crosses industries. You know, we're talking about how you do it with your food, and you pick your two or three like regional cuisines. When I was in tech, you don't focus on Power BI, Tableau, and Looker. You pick one of three platforms, and then you build around that one platform. And so, yeah, it's a mindset that is, like I said, just transfers no matter where you're at.
You've kind of lived so many different lives, from being in the tech world, being in theater, now being in the culinary space. What part of the process now, from the ideas phase to the logistical phase to actually putting out the product, is your favorite?
So I think for me, it is seeing the blend between the forethought that went into something and the minute-by-minute execution of actually producing that thing in real life. When I was in theater, you read lines that somebody else puts together for you. So you're not analytically thinking about like what you want to say. You're kind of like building off of that. When I was in analytics, you're not really interpreting the data, you're building the box that people look at, or the dashboard that people look at, to interpret data on their own. Food is, and fine dining in particular, is a perfect blend of like right brain and left brain, where I can be analytical and think about, you know, if I'm doing a dessert, you know, sugar caramelizes at these temperatures, or if I'm tempering chocolate, like all of the kind of technique and the kind of thought that has to go into producing something like that. But then that gets balanced by the actual working with my hands of creating a piece of food or a piece of art or whatever you want to call it, and ultimately seeing that go out. So if I spent all day just doing recipe development, I would really miss out on the opportunity to build and work with my hands. And if I was working with my hands all day, I would miss the creative challenge that comes along with, you know, thinking on an idea forever. So it's been this is the right balance for me.
That's perfect. I love seeing it all come to light. And I'm just, when we were connected, and again, I encourage our audience to check it out too. When we were connected, I just was diving down the rabbit hole of all that Logan's done. And it is just remarkable. As we kind of gear towards a winding down moment here, Logan, we have a closing litany that we dive into here at Chats with Clark.
Sure.
And it's a couple questions that we ask all our guests. And the first one is about gratitude. My contention is that people who live gratefully live a more fulfilled, a better life than those people who do not.
Sure.
And no pressure, but I guess the question now to you is, what role does gratitude play in your life?
Oh, it's, I would say that for me, being able to communicate to people the amount of effort that they're putting in and how big of an impact that has on you is paramount. That's what I think allows people to really, how do I want to describe this? That kind of gives people the the feeling that what they're doing is not just good for themselves, but good for others. That if I'm not acknowledging the good work that you're doing, then I am essentially telling you or not giving you information. So you might try something different and not realize that what you were doing was perfect. So, and that can be as complicated as like doing a yearly review and making sure that you talk about the important things. Or for me, it can be as simple as just calling everybody in the kitchen chef because I respect them all as if they were a chef. You know, if you come from a different background or, you know, where you've been in a place where people kind of see that as like a hierarchy thing, it might feel weird at first. But for me, I don't see chef as a title that is, you know, prescribed to you once you have a culinary degree or once you are a head chef. If the food can't come out of the kitchen without you being involved, whether you're the one that is plating the food or washing the dishes the food goes on, you're a chef. And so, yeah, that showing gratitude, showing respect for the people that are working for and with me is paramount. It's what separates a good leader from somebody that is just, you know, doing the extractive style of management where I'm going to take your skill set and use it to benefit me, but not give anything back to you.
So good. I think recognition is one of the best forms of gratitude too, because it takes the person recognizing to have a step back moment where they can analyze the situation and say, this is what's really great, this is what's really great, this is what's really great, and give out the praise, give out the love.
Sure.
And people thrive on recognition, right?
Absolutely.
When they're validated, when someone's humanity is validated, that's second to none for all of us.
Absolutely. No, definitely.
The next question for you is about regrets. Do you have any regrets in your life? And if so, what have they taught you?
Sure. If there's a regret that I have, it's being afraid of failing, because I would say that I, for a long time, saw failure as a terminal point, where once you've failed, that is it. You have failed, not realizing that failure is the first step in iterating. You know, there is no need to come back and do something better if you did it perfect on the first time, which means that you failed in some form on that first one, no matter how good or how bad the outcome was. And so understanding that failure is one, it's inevitable. And two, it's a form of criticism was really important for me. There's something to be learned from a failure. You don't just burn it all and move on to the next thought. You do an autopsy, and you look at and you see like a postmortem of what went wrong, how you might do things differently, and then you take that information and you do it again, and you keep doing it until eventually everything is going as well as you want it to. And you know, maybe that's doing learning a new skill or getting into cooking or starting your own business or asking for a raise. It's, you know, wherever it is that you're afraid of failing, just fail. But the world still turns, you're still going to be alive, so you might as well give somebody the opportunity to say yes, even if you're expecting the idea to be, or even if you're expecting a no. Because if you don't try, then it'll never happen. So what's the worst that happens? You try and it actually works out. It's not a bad
it's
idea.
Great.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it's the truth. I always think about that. If I was looking at like a number line, I'm like, okay, if we're here, and then if I ask, then if it's yes, then okay, I could get all the way up to here. But if I don't ask and I'm still here, and if I ask and they say no, I'm also still here.
Right.
Except I actually have a little more information, so I'm probably even a step ahead. So either way, you're moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. It's the whole Edison learning a million different ways that a light bulb doesn't work. So it's all in, yeah, how you frame it and how you're able to see that failure as a step towards the next success.
Speaking of the idea of next, the third question has to do with our calendars. I really believe that it's important to have something to look forward to. I think it adds a zeal and an excitement in our lives. What's on your calendar, Logan, that you're looking forward to?
Ooh, that's a good one. This is a really interesting question. So for me, I have time scheduled family. We've got every single year we try to get together for a vacation somewhere. And
nice.
So that is for many reasons, definitely something that I'm looking forward to. If I were to look at something that's not quite as, kind of like stereotypical as going on vacation, there's a number of coffee chats that I have on my calendar with area supper clubs, area restaurants, area chefs who are in the pop-up series or in the pop-up stage of their careers. Those conversations have been the catalyst for so many next plans. It's what's gotten me into Encore, was getting together for a coffee chat that, you know, we were just trying to get together and see if there was anything we had in common. Sure enough, it turned into this. And so, yeah, the coffee chats that I've got on my calendar are absolutely the things that I'm looking forward to the most, because not only are they helping me to move forward, but it's also helping me to explore, you know, more creatives in Cleveland and build the network that will ultimately help to lift the scene.
Those experiences that are bucket fillers are the best. Yeah. I think the more of those we have on our calendar, that's what all these episodes are for me. I'm so grateful for it. So, yeah.
Cool.
The fourth question's a new question, Logan. Added to our litany. So our new closing litany doesn't have four questions. Actually, it's five. So I kind of fibbed, I guess, a second ago. But the question is, every night when you lay down to go to bed, what is it that you hoped to have brought to the day?
So how I close my eyes at the end of the night, what allows me to go to sleep is knowing that the effort that I'm putting in to this is not just coming back to help me. For me, it's how am I benefiting the mass? How am I benefiting the many? And how does what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis build for the next group that comes in? That's ultimately for me the important part. It's, yeah, have I made somebody else feel more creative or more inspired to do their next thing? If so, I'll sleep like a baby.
Your world is all about bringing people together. We've been talking about it throughout the conversation. So it makes sense that would be, well, you're doing it. So it makes sense to me that when you go to bed, if I've brought more people together, if I've brought the good out of others, then I'm doing what I'm striving to
Definitely. Do. Yep. And just kind of remind people of the kind of culture that sits around, you know. Maybe, you know, Cleveland hasn't necessarily been seen as that cultural epicenter, you know, we're the mistake on the lake, right? But there's actually a lot of stuff hidden here. And so as I do the food and as I do things to kind of awaken that, I hope that other people start to see that too.
Amen. Do you have any closing thoughts or any piece of advice that you would tailor to either a specific sect of the audience or the audience abroad?
So my general words of advice that I like to give is keep one eye in the telescope and the other eye in the microscope. Mm. So with your eye in the telescope that's focusing on your long term, figure out where you want to be, what's your 5-year goals, what's your 10-year goals. And then don't just leave that in the vacuum. As you go about your day to day, as you're looking through the microscope at the minute details of everyday life, think about how is what I'm seeing here relating to that big picture, and just continually try to relate it back to the big picture. And if it doesn't line up, cut it. Figure out what you can do to spend less time on that. And if it does, build it. Figure out how you can get more time dedicated to doing that, because ultimately your day-to-day actions are what take you closer or farther away from your long-term goals. And if you're not keeping an eye on both of those, you'll stray in one form or the other.
Wow, that's so, I've never heard that before. Thanks. One in the telescope, one in the microscope. I've never heard that before.
I'm sure I stole it from somewhere.
We're giving it to Chef Wong. Boom, right in there.
There we go.
Logan, I can't thank you enough for diving into this conversation with me and just sharing your stories. I think that Cleveland is so lucky to have you and everyone that comes to experience your cooking, your history in food, basically. You're telling stories through food, diving into Cleveland's rich history. I mean, the cigar is so good.
Thank
the Mistake on the Lake piece is so good. All of them
appreciate
are so
it,
good.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough. This has been enthralling. And like I mentioned just a couple minutes ago, they really are bucket filler situations for me. So I thank you for that opportunity appreciate having you here on episode 67 of Chats with Clark. It's crazy that we're just keep piling these numbers up. They're getting bigger and bigger, but that's what it is. And I'm excited about it. So to our audience, thank you for listening. Hit the subscribe button. I don't know what you're waiting for. We'd love to have you as part of our audience consecutively. If you keep coming back, you should have already hit it. I don't know what you're waiting on. But all of the links for Chef Lo, for Logan Nizel, and for Chats with Clark will be in the description below or somewhere in the pinned comments. You'll find it. But definitely check out all of the cooking and great things that are going on in Logan's world. And we would love to have you back at Chats with Clark. Again, I'm your host, Joe Clark, signing off of another episode 67 of Chats with Clark. Thanks for listening.